Jessica Gnauer, lecturer in international relations at Flinders University in Australia. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Matthew Sussex. Matthew is an associate professor and fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. Matthew focuses on Russian foreign and security policy, as well as hybrid warfare. So I'm very pleased to be having a discussion with Matthew today on these very interesting topics. Thanks so much for joining me today, Matthew.
Thanks so much, Jessica, and thanks for that lovely welcome. Great to be with you.
Since 2014, with the Russian annexation of Crimea and incursions into the southeastern territory of Ukraine, it's been noted that Russia has engaged in what's called hybrid warfare, using both direct military tactics as well as less conventional strategies such as disinformation, cyber attacks, etc. Can you define for listeners the concept of hybrid warfare? And also, do you think that the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February this year was a fundamental shift in strategy from hybrid conflict to a strategy of direct military confrontation?
That's an excellent question with about 150 different for me to go down. Unfortunately, with terms like these, they're both subjective and contextual. So you're not going to hit on, I think, a definition of hybrid that adequately can be used as a way to explain what we in political science would refer to as commonplaces. They tend to define the particular rather and the unique rather than the general. That said, it's a term that's entered into the academic parlance for better or worse, along with all the others like grey area phenomena, cyber-enabled information operations. But then, of course, hybrid is bigger than that. Hybrid can also include not only political warfare, the way we understand that, and sort of misinformation, disinformation campaigns and espionage, but also potentially military operations too. And I think that's why hybrid is a little bit different, that it encompasses the military arts by deception or maskirovka, which the Russians like to try and practice, as well as those non-kinetic aspects of warfare. And if you understand it in that way, effectively what you're saying is that hybrid war is non-linear warfare. It doesn't progress from, you know, tensions between one nation state and another to, you know, diplomatic notes to, you know, potentially acts of espionage and cyber and then insurgencies and then on the path to full-scale war. Rather, hybrid operates as a sort of sense of total war, if you like. And this is why I think it has provoked so much interest in the West, partly because that really doesn't sum up the way that the West has come to view war. And you might make the argument that, well, perhaps the West has got it wrong. Perhaps, in fact, that by viewing war as incredibly rules-bound, as effectively, you know, police actions, highly conditioned by the international community, by the United Nations, by rules and laws of war, and so forth, maybe we've lost our understanding of what war might be. The flip side of that, of course, is that if you are to employ such tactics, you're going to have very little regard for such rules and norms and so forth. And I think this is probably demonstrated by what the Russian Federation has done, not just in Ukraine, but more broadly throughout the European Union as well. The interference in the affairs of sovereign states, use of hacking, cyber, compromat, manipulation of political ecosystems, manipulation of information ecosystems. And that's basically what it's done.
Mm-hmm. And before we go on to the second question of whether the 24th of February this year represented a fundamental shift in Russia's strategy, can you talk a bit more about the concept that you mentioned of the art of military conflict by deception? That sounded really interesting. Is that a concept that's common to Russian political elites?
Oh, absolutely. Maskirovka is the Russian word for it, and it simply means military arts by deception. So to look as though you might be intending to do one thing and then do another, or alternatively, if you join that up with messaging and rhetoric, then, you know, the use of hints, threats, suggestions as to what you might do, which veils your actually intended purpose. That said, of course, you know, the way the Russians went about it, they pretty much did what they said they were going to do. And cutting through all the noise, there wasn't much of an attempt at diplomacy before they invaded in February 24.
Mm-hmm. So you would see a clear change in strategy there.
From Crimea to 2022 is a different proposition, because in 2022, Russia does change and says, okay, we're going to launch a blitzkrieg-style invasion with some caveats into Ukraine along four fronts. And you can't do that with hybrid warfare. That is a much more classical conventional military operation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's very interesting, because it seemed to me Russia had actually been quite successful about what they'd been doing pre-24th of February, in the sense that the so-called international community largely tended to ignore the fact that there were some incursions onto Ukrainian territory. And then there was certainly a shift in that response once there was the full-scale military invasion.
Well, I mean, I suppose it was more than just incursions. It was 8 years of warfare. You ask a Ukrainian, and they would say that they'd been fighting Russia for 8 years in the Donbass, in Donetsk and Luhansk. So, yeah, there was the combination of lawfare, you know, recognizing, aiding the Kremlin-sponsored insurgency. But that wasn't achieving the objectives that Russia had set out for itself. And I think those objectives actually did change over time. If you look at what Putin did, he penned, apparently, an essay last year in which he said, basically, Ukrainians have no identity. They have no language. They have no culture. All of it is Russian. You know, the Ukrainians are just Russians who've forgotten who they are, effectively denying the existence of a sovereign nation state. Mm-hmm. So Putin writes that letter. He then has this sham diplomatic merry-go-round in which foreign leaders come and ask him not to invade after, you know, marshalling an enormous force on the Ukrainian border. And then after that, he just simply rolls the tanks over. And I think the thinking was that Russia would be able to capture Kyiv very, very quickly, force Zelensky, the president, to flee or capture him and make him sign a surrender document. And it was anticipated by the Russian general staff, as we know, that they thought that they would win in 3 days. Being able to take over that amount of territory with millions and millions of people living there is certainly an appealing prospect if you can do it. But evidently, Putin and his generals underestimated the degree to which the Ukrainians would resist and completely overestimated the strength of their own forces.
Yeah, so in some ways, a case of miscalculation, almost stumbling into that far more protracted, ongoing conventional military conflict in a way that was not necessarily intentional or anticipated. So is there anything else that you would add regarding the explanations for the current invasion of Ukraine?
Well, look, I mean, the two schools of thought, or the big debate on, you know, what is the origins of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is the conventional sort of Mearsheimer approach, which is NATO's to blame and NATO expansion is to blame. NATO created so many insecurities for Russia that it was forced to lash out. That's one view. It's certainly one I subscribed to early on, and I've been watching Russia for a very long time. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, I thought NATO expansion was silly. That provided Russia with a voice but no veto. The longer, however, Putin has been in office, I think it's become quite clear, really, that this is something that he feels deeply personally, that he wants to achieve. He wants to recreate the geopolitical footprint of the USSR, if not its ideology. And he perceives, rightly or wrongly, that the West is moribund, that NATO is rudderless, and that nothing would happen if he did, in fact, invade Ukraine, or very little. The thing I think that's a bit galling in the West is, well, frankly, had they won in 3 days, then that's probably what Putin would have ended up with. Sanctions, a slap on the wrist, and that's it. So in terms of how the conflict comes about, no, I do think that this is something that has been produced by an individual himself.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I appreciate your perspective on that, because it is quite contentious. You know, to what extent is this really a feeling of a lack of security because of the expansion of NATO? Looking at the further implications of the conflict, it's been noted that there will be ripple effects and ramifications for many regions, many continents. And even if this military conflict were to end tomorrow, there would be deep felt emotional and mental impacts for Russian society, for Ukrainian society, and we could even say all across Europe and potentially other countries worldwide. So could you talk a bit about how you see the implications of the conflict for Russia's future relations with, for want of a better word, the West?
Look, let me start at Ukraine and then move outwards. Russia has certainly succeeded in making enemies of Ukrainians for the foreseeable future, probably 100 years, if not longer. The way that the Russian armed forces have conducted themselves in Ukraine has bizarrely, you know, taken a country where you did have significant support for Russia to one in which there is none and there is absolute hatred.
Yes, that's something that's going to be felt for generations, I'm sure.
More broadly, you know, if we talk about the NATO space and the West space, Putin has succeeded in bringing about something he didn't want, which was NATO enlargement. If we look at the prospects for Finland and Sweden joining NATO, which they seem quite keen on doing, and that's a significant departure from their previous positions. Overall, I think that Putin and the West are done. I think that's it. As long as he remains in power, there's going to be considerable suspicion of his motives, of his objectives in any type of negotiation. And I think a pathway back to even the most rudimentary relationship between Russia and, let's call it, the West, I suppose the transatlantic space particularly, is going to be exceptionally difficult. And even though there's still a variance of views within NATO about how harshly Russia should be treated, I think there is a broad understanding that doing business with Putin is absolutely fraught with risk. So Russia has created the conditions, or Putin has created the conditions that match his rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. I know you've also looked further eastwards from Russia. Something of an elephant in the room is the role of China in all of this, because clearly they're a huge economic power, and whichever way they choose to fall, to what extent they decide to support Russia economically, even if not militarily, is going to have a really big difference on what happens in future. So how is China's role in this going to play out?
Well, I think on one level, the Chinese are very annoyed that they have this forever partner with a sort of no limits partnership, very annoyed that this partner of theirs, who is the junior partner in that relationship, continues to undermine PRC messaging, which is, you know, centered around non-intervention, peaceful coexistence and development and so forth. Russia, by contrast, operates as a kind of wrecking ball for the international order, whereas China wants to modify that order to suit it. And having Russia go and do these things on at least the normative plane is not very helpful. That said, however, I think the Chinese do see an interest and an incentive for the conflict to go on as long as possible, to weaken Russia as much as possible, because they know that the thing that Russia will need fundamentally after this conflict is to be able to trade with someone, anyone. And the chief things it has at its disposal, as we know, is lots and lots of natural resources, and particularly oil and gas. So I think China views this as an opportunity. And again, funnily enough, through decisions Putin has made himself, giving Russia no option, but to effectively be a supplicant to the PRC. Now, even during times of peace or sort of semi-war in Ukraine, I suppose, the Chinese had managed to engineer a situation where their infrastructure development programs, where their investment was going only into those things that China needed, and not translating into broader scale benefits for Russian society in the Far East. And I think that there'll be every incentive in Beijing to continue doing that and to effectively turn Russia into a sort of raw materials appendage. And it would be difficult, I think, for Russia to conceive of a future that is any way otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yes, China viewing this very much through the lens of their own domestic economic interests. Final question. We know that there is reportedly, you know, just very strong support amongst the Russian broad society for the special military operation. I know it's not called a war within Russia, but someone who has more understanding of Russian society and culture and more familiarity, how do you make sense of that widespread support? Does it surprise you, or does that make sense to you with what you know?
No one wants to live in a country that is viewed by others as rubbish, even if daily life looks like that. Patriotism comes from a variety of different cultural myths, totems, and so forth. But I think in the Russian context, it's fear of weakness and memory of weakness after the collapse of the USSR that really does drive a lot of this support for Putin. And he's had a long time now. He's had two decades to work on Russian identity. Russia exited the Soviet Union without a unifying national idea. And to some extent, it still doesn't have one. But the one that Putin is offering is anti-Westernism. And this has resonance. It has resonance with people whose experience of democracy and capitalism is extremely negative, one which created a class of oligarchs and made everybody else poor, one where inflation rates were just through the roof in the late 1990s, where prisoners in Russian jails ate better than soldiers. So the defining mission, I think, of Putin has been to try and recreate this sense of another Russian word, državnost. And that means thinking and acting like a great power and ultimately being respected as a great power.
Mm.
And that really resonates with Russians.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the extent of support, there are a lot of people, of course, who just simply will not question or will not be caught questioning the government because there are so many instruments that the regime can use to make life difficult. It's not just beating and arrests. It's losing your job. It's being ostracized in your social circles. It's your children losing access to school, childcare, and so forth. So a lot of people just simply parrot the official line or opt out. You know, there have been recent surveys where between 85 and 90% of respondents simply refuse to participate in polls.
Wow.
But that said, such is the structural power of the Putin regime, that there are, you know, very little prospect, I think, of the Russian people, at least anytime soon, rising up to overthrow him. And, you know, better just to parrot the official line. Otherwise, there are problems for you and for your family. And, and when that hits you at that personal level, it's something I think that introduces a different type of choice dynamic.
Well, thank you so much for your insights today. I've really enjoyed the conversation and I feel like I'm taking away a better understanding of a few different aspects to the conflict. So I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining me.
Absolute pleasure, Jessica. Thanks so very much.
You've been listening to the Update from Kyiv podcast. Thanks to Mr. Smith for our theme music. See you next episode.